Lecture 36, South Asia into the 21st Century.
When we consider the Indian subcontinent today, we can see how the major themes of its long history have expressed themselves into the 21st century. We've seen how diverse South Asia became over many centuries, developing local and regional variations in culture, society, economy, and politics. Much of this variety within each South Asian nation remains both culturally enriching and also, on occasion, a source of conflict. Despite the subcontinent's great ecological and cultural variety, there are also vital overarching patterns like the seasonal monsoon rains. Cultural linkages emerge that are shared by people living in every region. Historically, these include popular identification with a trans-regional religious system, especially Hinduism, or, for the last millennium, Islam. Today, this includes widespread commitment to representative parliamentary democracy. Each nation has had periods of authoritarianism, some longer, more intense, or more frequent than others. Currently, however, India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh have functioning democracies, and we trust that their days of military and other repressive rule are over. We've also seen how the people of South Asia interacted over time with larger intercontinental processes, like waves of immigration and emigration, the spread of Islam, and 500 years of globalization. All these factors are very much present and have even intensified during the 21st century. In this final lecture, we'll first briefly review some of the larger themes in South Asian history that are still important today. Then we'll turn to consider some of the current conditions in each of today's major South Asian nations individually. Finally, we'll conclude with some of the major issues facing South Asia as a whole, now and into the future. The interacting histories of a complex variety of individuals and communities has produced South Asia's great diversity, as we've seen as a major theme during all these lectures. Starting some 60 to 70,000 years ago, various groups with their own cultural heritage and social organization immigrated and settled in each ecologically specific region of the subcontinent. Over subsequent centuries, the developments of the economy, diet, and general ways of life have been shaped by that region's distinct physical environment, including natural factors like the amount of rainfall, the flow of rivers, the effects of mountain ranges, and their location on the coast or inland. One result has been dozens of different languages, with each region developing and still having one or more of its own, with a variety of distinct local dialects. Over many centuries, a persistent social and economic pattern found in many regions has been pastoralists and shifting agriculturalists settling as farmers, then clearing farmland by cutting down forests and pushing back forest-dependent people. Today, the resource demands of cities and industries are putting further stresses on the remaining forest-dwelling communities. Tensions among these several different ways of life continue. For example, when settled villagers or the government claim exclusive forest rights and exclude herders and adivasis who have traditionally used those forests as well. Or when dams dislocate local communities, even as they produce much-needed electricity and irrigation water for the nation. Rural populations have been migrating temporarily or permanently to cities for centuries, but the rate has dramatically increased in recent decades. Among the dozen largest megacities in the world today are India's Delhi and Mumbai, Pakistan's Karachi, and Bangladesh's Dhaka, with populations of 15 million or more each, roughly double that of New York City. Other identities, like social and economic status and religious beliefs and practices, also vary at the very local level, by region, and across the subcontinent. There are inequities based on class, caste, and gender within each region and the nation, although to different degrees. We've also seen how much political differentiation there has been and always has been in South Asia. As you'll recall, very few times in history has the entire subcontinent been under one government. Only relatively short-lived empires have sporadically conquered much of South Asia from the 3rd century BCE onward. The two longest-lasting of these empires were formed in different ways by outside conquerors. One of them settled and became Indian, the other never did. These were the Mughal Empire, which lasted from the mid-16th through the 17th century before gradually fragmenting, and the British Empire, which lasted from the late 18th to the mid-20th centuries. So South Asia's present political division into the separate independent nations of India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh is not unusual. Each nation is the product of its regional and trans-regional histories, with many geographical boundaries set by the British colonial Raj still being disputed. The partition of Pakistan from India in 1947 marked a major redistribution of people on the basis of their religion, Muslim or non-Muslim. India and Pakistan have nuclear weapons and the means to deliver them with missiles and aircraft. They have also gone to war against each other multiple times. Further, within each of these countries, there are strong tensions between national and subnational loyalties based on region, community, and religion. Another major theme we've been following is the relationship between South Asians and the surrounding world. Throughout history, this has included the Indian Ocean region from East Africa to Southeast Asia and China, and also by land, all of Eurasia. But for the last 5 centuries, this has encompassed the entire globe, especially via European ships during the colonial period. More recently, various people in each of the new nations of South Asia have been ever more deeply incorporated into systems of world production and trade, international political and religious movements, and intercultural exchanges. Diaspora communities from India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh have mixed their families' cultures with the American, European, African, and Asian societies where they've gone to settle. Now let's briefly survey the contemporary situations in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, which have featured in recent lectures. The state and nation that dominates South Asia in population, geographical size, and economic, political, and military power is, of course, the Republic of India. Over the next decade, it will become the largest nation in the world, surpassing China. India is also emerging as an economic powerhouse with ever more influence in the world. But, like the other South Asian countries, the issue of national identity remains heatedly debated. The founders of the nation 70 years ago decided to use the name India in part to stress continuity with the Indian subcontinent as a whole. Many of these founders opposed the partitioning off of large sections of India in 1947 to form Pakistan. So in their minds, India was the original, and Pakistan an invalid creation of the outgoing British. But in Indian languages, the nation is called Bharat. This name has strong Hindu associations, referring to the descendants of the legendary king Bharat and other semi-divine figures from Sanskrit-based cultural traditions. Many non-Hindu minority citizens may not feel strong identification with that other formulation of their nation. So this dual terminology points to an ongoing political and ideological debate about national identity. On one hand, Jawaharlal Nehru and his political allies and heirs stressed the secular, incorporative nature of the nation. They argued that the large minority of India's Muslim citizens and the smaller minorities of its Sikh, Jain, Christian, and other citizens should have equally respected roles in the nation. For the most part, the Congress Party and its left-wing factions and sometimes allied communist and socialist parties have tended to represent that position and to have protected minority citizens from the Hindu majority. But on the other hand, the current Bharatiya Janata Party government and other parties on the so-called Hindu right have accused the Congress Party of being pseudo-secularist, that is, of not treating all of Bharat's citizens equally. This has meant that the 80% Hindu majority's interests do not prevail as they should in a true representative, one person, one equal vote democracy. Each model of the nation thus has its competing supporters who have alternated in power over the past decades. At this time, the current Congress leadership is quite weak. The Nehru-Gandhi dynasty has led the Congress since Indian independence. Nehru, then his daughter Indira Gandhi, then his grandson Rajiv Gandhi, provided remarkable continuity over that period. With the one exception of the two-year state of emergency from 1975 to 77, India has been highly unusual among former colonies around the world for its strong and continuous commitment to democracy. The Congress Party largely held together despite various splits due to the primacy of that dynasty. Even today, the strongest figure in the Congress is Rajiv Gandhi's widow, Sonia, although she is an Italian-born immigrant. In contrast, in recent decades, the BJP has, with some setbacks, been sporadically rising across the north and in the center of India especially. BJP Prime Minister A.B. Vajpayee held office three times, the longest from 1998 to 2004, but as the head of a loose coalition of parties. In 2014, BJP Prime Minister Narendra Modi won a decisive victory that has allowed him to lead a unified, largely one-party government. This ended the three-decade-long pattern of coalition or minority governments that prevented implementation of strong policies to reshape the economy and nation. Prime Minister Modi has proven himself to be pro-business, trying to free the economy from Nehruvian-style socialism and government regulation. But these changes have also lessened some of the environmental protections imposed by Mrs. Gandhi's government, which the BJP feels have also limited Bharat's economic development. In addition to the Congress and the BJP, there are various smaller parties that have had their own platforms. Several communist and other left-leaning political parties have not succeeded in expanding beyond their respective regional bases in order to displace the Congress as the leader of this secular model for India. Several regions have their own political parties, but none of these extends beyond that single provincial base. There are also small parties that primarily represent particular caste groupings, including the Bahujan Samaj Party, which appeals to Dalit, people historically degraded as untouchables. Even more marginalized groups have turned to Maoist-style revolution. Up to a third of India's districts, almost all of them rural and heavily forested where Adivasis live, are currently sites of such left-wing insurgency. Within India, secessionist movements have been largely suppressed by the national government, although there are still some ongoing, especially in the Kashmir and in the northeast. But cultural nationalism within the Indian Union has been widely accepted. Since the 1950s, many new states based on regional cultures have been created by dividing earlier states. The most recent of these dates to 2014 with the separation of Telangana from Andhra Pradesh. Over time, however, the Indian national identity has strengthened, especially as people have migrated and settled in states outside of their regional homelands. They have come to share ever more with their fellow Indian citizens. Pakistan was partitioned off in 1947 as a nation for Muslims. It contains the sixth largest population of any country on earth. But debate continues among its citizens about how much being Muslim should matter in their identity. Various Pakistani politicians, including its founding leader, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, in his final year of life, have called for a nation in which all citizens are equal, regardless of their religion. Nonetheless, almost all non-Muslims left in the West Wing of Pakistan at the time of partition left, with only 3% remaining who are not Muslim. Yet the relationship between Islam and the state has remained a hotly contested issue. Even the more left-wing political parties have evoked Islam. This has been particularly true of the Pakistan People's Party, founded and led by Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, then by his daughter, Benazir Bhutto, and now by his grandson, Bilawal Bhutto. Other political parties have appealed to Islam even more, although to different extents. This includes the Pakistan Muslim League, led by three-time and current Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. A range of predominantly Islamist parties includes those participating in the democratic process and those more militantly opposed to the government. But among those parties who concur that Pakistan should be an Islamic state, there are strong conflicts about who is really a Muslim practicing true Islam. The majority of Pakistanis follow the Sunni tradition. Many see the substantial minority of Shiites and also followers of Sufism as not being true Muslims. There is also the small Ahmadiyya community that believes itself Muslim, but which has been legally classified as non-Muslim. Further, even among practicing Muslims, there are disagreements about how Islamic the government should be. Should it fund Islamic academies, schools, and other educational institutions? Should Islamic Sharia law prevail over British-based civil law? In some parts of Pakistan, Sharia is already in place. In most of the country, however, it is not. As in the Republic of India, strong regional identities have cut across Pakistan's national identity. This occurred most dramatically in 1971, when the Eastern Wing seceded as independent Bangladesh. Even within the Western Wing, which became modern-day Pakistan, these sub-nationalist sentiments have continued for and within each of the remaining regionally-based provinces. Most political parties have predominantly regional identities. The currently ruling Pakistan Muslim League, for instance, is strongly identified with the Punjab. Since the Punjab contains about two-thirds of Pakistan's citizens, this gives the League a major advantage in elections. But each of Pakistan's other provinces has sought greater autonomy. Even the megacity of Karachi, the economic and political base of the Muhajirs, who immigrated from India in 1947, has at times sought autonomy from the surrounding province of Sindh, or, even less persuasively, from Pakistan itself. At present, there are ongoing guerrilla movements for independence in both Balochistan and in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, where the Pakistan Army is struggling to retain authority. So Pakistan and its people face challenges, both external and internal. Since Bangladesh split off from Pakistan in 1971, it has largely resolved its main regional issue. The relatively small percentage of the population who are non-Bengali Adivasi, living in a distinct highland region in the southeast, have negotiated an understanding with the government. But Bihari immigrants still largely remain apart from the rest of society. But the issue of Bengali versus Muslim identities is still debated. The party strongly in power at this time, the Awami League, has tended to highlight Bengali identity. It has tended to ally itself with India and to try to suppress Islamist movements that threaten its dominance. The main opposition, the Bangladesh Nationalist Party, is currently weaker than it has been for much of its history, as are its frequent Islamist political partners. Many of the services that the Bangladesh government has not been adequately providing are made available by non-governmental organizations, NGOs. Some are international, but many of the strongest are domestic. The two largest Bangladeshi NGOs are the Grameen Bank, started in 1976 by Nobel Prize winner Muhammad Yunus, and the even larger BRAC, started by Sir Fazlul Hasan Abid in 1972. Between them and other NGOs, nearly all poor Bangladeshi women have access to microcredit. Making small loans to millions of women has enabled them to start to lift their families out of a cycle of debt and thus above poverty. In addition, both BRAC and the Grameen Bank provide an array of other services, including education, communication, and healthcare. The people of Bangladesh may be poor, but their lives are improving, due in large measure to these NGOs, even more than in India or Pakistan, where the governments are relatively stronger. Indeed, Bangladesh, although containing a higher percentage of people with low incomes than India or Pakistan, has better life expectancy, child and mother survival, and female literacy rates. While each nation has its own history, they also share much. To live in any of these South Asian nations is to be immersed in a rich array of cultures on a daily basis. The languages people speak vary depending on the immediate circumstances. Each region and sub-region has its own distinctive language and dialects. But there are also link languages that are trans-regional. So when strangers meet on the streets of a cosmopolitan city, they need to figure out from the appearance of the other what language to use. The factors include clothing, physical features, and occupation. But often people have no language in common. For instance, India's parliament, and even its cabinet at times, needs translators since there's no single language that everybody understands. Different communities contribute in complementary ways to the larger society. But these can also be a source of tension, since conflicting regional and cultural religious identities have racked each of the South Asian nations. Much of the intensity of these conflicts comes from the issue of inequality of access to increasingly overburdened resources. Together, the people of South Asia make up 20% of the world's population, one in every five people on Earth. But they live on less than 3% of its landmass, about a quarter as much as the U.S. About a third of all the world's poor live in South Asia. Today, all of South Asia is facing a critical period when water, energy, and other natural resources are overstrained by ever larger populations and increased agricultural and industrial production. Since the last century or so, most people have lived ever more densely on the land or in rapidly expanding cities. This rapid growth has resulted in relatively young populations. This could produce a demographic dividend of a labor pool approaching its peak productivity just at the time when China, Japan, and Europe's workforces are aging. But if these young men and women remain unemployed, their frustration could erupt in social disorder. Hence, each South Asian nation is attempting to reduce the rate of population rise and to grow its economy to make jobs for its youth. Yet another issue that affects all these South Asian nations is gender disparity. Due to economic and cultural preference for sons rather than daughters, most regions have very imbalanced sex ratios. There are many million fewer women in the population than there would be expected statistically. Anemia, stunting, and other results of chronic malnutrition affect many women, leading to higher mortality in childbearing. Women in most regions of South Asia have markedly lower literacy rates than men. Since primary education for women is one of the most efficient ways of increasing the quality of life for everyone, this is an area that each government in South Asia is addressing, although to differing degrees. However, the status of women is more complex than that. India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh have each had one or more women prime ministers. Mrs. Indira Gandhi was elected prime minister in 1966 and again in 1980. In Pakistan, Mrs. Benazir Bhutto was elected in 1988 and again in 1993. And in Bangladesh, Begum Khalida Zia was elected in 1991 and again in 2001, alternating with Sheikh Hasina, who was elected in 1996, 2009, and yet again in 2014. Significantly, none of these women rose up through women's movements, nor were they particularly known for pro-women laws. Rather, they were each the daughter or wife of a charismatic national leader who died in office or was assassinated, a martyr for the nation. Therefore, these four women each inherited their initial elected position, although once in office, they each proved independently powerful. At the regional level, in contrast, some of the most fiery leaders are single women. In Bengal, Mamata Banerjee leads the Trinamool, or Grassroots Congress. In Tamil Nadu, Jayalalitha leads the AIADMK. And in Uttar Pradesh, Mayawati leads the Bahujan Samaj Party. Each has been a chief minister between one and five times. Significantly, none has married, but rather each has risen up due to her own political charisma, although Jayalalitha and Mayawati had male mentors who advanced their careers initially. There is a relatively small but growing commerce among South Asian nations. but that is dwarfed by trade with the more prosperous economies elsewhere. Indian, Pakistani, and Bangladeshi middle and upper classes of businessmen and professionals are entrepreneurially expanding their nation's share in the world economic system. Their growing incomes enable them to enjoy the global market for consumer goods. All this globalization has brought opportunities and benefits to many South Asians, but also threats and costs to others. Should intellectual property rights mean that the poor of South Asia pay high prices for vital seeds and medicines that profit multinational corporations when inexpensive local copies could be manufactured? The globalized production of clothing has created work for semi-skilled workers. However, these jobs are low-paying and often dangerous. Nonetheless, India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh have had to compete with each other to produce goods that provide much of the profit to corporations based in the richer developed world. As another component of increasing globalization, tens of millions of immigrants from India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh and their descendants have been contributing greatly to the many countries in the Americas, Europe, and Africa, and elsewhere in Asia, where they have settled. Many of them send back remittances, transferring some of their hard-earned income to their families, a major contribution to the local economies. The growing number of South Asian sojourners abroad have been returning with skills and capital that enrich their homeland. While overseas immigrants from South Asia also assist in spreading their cultural heritage worldwide, for instance, their cuisine, yoga, and Bollywood cinema, many nations in the world have Hindu temples funded by Indian associations. Some analysts call these cultural influences soft power. Many immigrants have done very well in business, in the computer industry, and in medical or educational professions, and in other fields where entrepreneurship can lead to success. Several members of the American Congress and the governors of Louisiana and South Carolina have been men and women of Indian origin. In Britain, several members of the House of Commons and House of Lords are of South Asian descent. The governments of their South Asian homelands have made efforts to retain their expatriates' loyalties and to gain from their skills and capital earned by hard work and initiative overseas. So the Indian subcontinent and its people and cultures have been ever more globally integrated. Many global forces are beyond the power of South Asians to control, like climate change. Rising sea levels flood low-lying coasts, especially during tidal surges. Since the South Asian coastal economy has been especially rich in agriculture and fishing, often these areas are densely populated. The Sundarbans, or beautiful forest, along the coast of Bangladesh and eastern India, is the largest mangrove forest in the world. Pakistan's southern coast also has extensive mangrove forests. Mangrove forests are especially rich in biodiversity. But dire predictions project the permanent flooding of about 15% of the entire nation of Bangladesh by the end of this century. Another result of global warming is the melting of glaciers in the Himalayas, which have long provided fresh water for India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. There is the looming danger of changes in the rainfall patterns of the vital monsoons, which need to be reliable in order for crops and cities to have enough water. South Asia is a tectonic plate that is grinding into Asia. This produces major earthquakes every half dozen years. Likewise, the 2004 tsunami devastated coastal regions with some damage still not repaired. So each South Asian nation tries to mitigate the negative effects of world processes that its people had little part in creating. Much of the carbon space in the world's atmosphere has already been filled up by European and American emissions over the last two centuries, causing today's climate change. South Asian people did not get their chance to add to the stock of carbon dioxide in the air. So their leaders demand environmental justice, that is, the right to produce more greenhouse gases until they reach the average per capita output of Westerners. These Indian, Pakistani, and Bangladeshi politicians have also negotiated billions of dollars for environmental improvements paid by already developed nations. In future, the people of South Asia will continue to emerge as a vital part of humanity. India in particular may replace China as the world's most dynamic developing economy, with Pakistan and Bangladesh substantially increasing their contributions as well. Politically, each of these relatively new nations faces challenges, including international terrorism, the threat of nuclear war, and internal social, religious, and subnational tensions. But the people of each nation have proven themselves resilient. Understanding the long history of the people and cultures of the Indian subcontinent, from their origins to the present, we can better appreciate all these developing patterns and the major reasons for them. Over the years to come, India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh will each have growing influences on all of our lives.
We hope you have enjoyed these lectures from the Great Courses. Our courses are available online or via the free Great Courses app for smartphones and tablets, available on the App Store or Google Play. View our full library at thegreatcourses.com. Or as always, you can call our customer care representatives at 1-800-832-2412. Thank you very much.